Wow, I have been so blown away by the feedback from my students inside the Design Business Accelerator. You guys are giving me life. I am so motivated to create more to help you succeed in your business and create the interior design business of your dreams. With that, I am totally on board for creating more content that helps you get where you need to go faster for a more profitable and successful business. So stay tuned as we're about to launch client presentations that convert. So many of you have asked me for that. I know you want in, and that Trello tutorial and templates is totally a game changer for those of you that really need help on process. Want to know what I'm talking about? Go check it out. It's at designbiztoolkit.com. We're having a 50% special right now. I know, like really huge enrollment special. So run on over to www.designbiztoolkit.com and I'll tell you all about it. All right. Thanks for being here. Let's jump into the next episode of Behind the Drapery.
Ever thought about starting your own business as an interior designer? Join Liz Levin, nationally published design entrepreneur of 20 years, as she interviews experts, colleagues, and creatives to pull back the curtain on the design industry. Whether you're passionate about design, eager to start your design business, or simply curious about what happens behind the scenes, we're here to open the doors for you. Welcome to Behind the Drapery Podcast.
Hey friends, today I'm so excited to bring a good friend and colleague, Marika Meyer, to the podcast. Marika and I have come up together as young designers in the Washington, D.C. area for the past 20 years. As friends and colleagues, we could talk for hours about the design world, our client projects, families, all the things. Marika has a world of experience under her belt, and I am thrilled to bring that to you today on Behind the Drapery. In addition to her full-service interior design firm, Marika Meyer Studio, where she has multiple team members managing so many high-end projects at a time, somehow she's also found the space to create her passion project, Marika Meyer Textiles. Launched over 5 years ago, it's a go-to favorite for interior designers. Through her rigorous testing to ensure quality, functionality, and longevity, her fabric collection and rugs are created to help provide a beautiful and uniquely practical tool for fellow interior designers in their role as the chief problem solver. With a simple process for creating custom pieces, she helps designers realize their dreams, clients' needs, and aesthetics. Today, anyone can bring a touch of timeless style and iconic imagery into their home with her fabrics and rug collection. Available in distinctive colors, patterns, and textures, and available by the yard or as pillows, her textiles are designed to fit every need and are fully customizable. True to her company's ethos, she believes life is not a dress rehearsal, and no one needs permission to enjoy everyday luxuries, especially at home. Marika engages her clients to create beautiful, functional spaces that embody their own unique energy and aesthetic. I am so excited to have Marika here today. You're going to learn so much. And if you've ever wanted to start a textile or fabric line, we're going to tell you how. So let's jump in and welcome Marika Meyer to this week's episode of Behind the Drapery. I'm your host, Liz Levin. Marika, I'm so glad you're here today on Behind the Drapery. Welcome.
I'm so excited to be here and to spend this time together.
Yes. And we could talk about a million things because we've come up together through the last 15 to 20 years, right? I know. So many years.
Oh, so many years. So many years.
And the point of this podcast project has been to really pull back the curtain, so to speak, and share with upcoming designers and people kind of curious about what happens behind the scenes, sort of how all of us people, designers that have been doing this for so long, got into the business, kind of share some war stories, so to speak, and really, you know, provide some practical advice and inspiration. And it's been a wonderful experiment and project. I've been getting feedback from people saying this is really inspiring me and helping me and motivating me to keep going, because no matter what level you're at in this industry, we all are experiencing similar challenges, whether it's with pricing and clients and pipeline and keeping everybody busy when you build your team. And I know we could talk about all of those topics. And I think with Sally and some of the others, I've said, we need to do a part two. Everybody comes back and we continue. But for you today, I'm particularly interested since we think we should share how you got into the business, you know, sort of your early story. We can start there. And then I really want to dive into
your textile and your rug line and all of the things, and really able to scale your business in a different way, because that is really intriguing to me, something I haven't done. So let's go back in the way back.
Way back.
Yeah, go to the beginning.
Way, way back. The very beginning.
Very beginning. So
I started working, I think it was like 3 days after my college graduation, at the in the memo library at Duncan Huggins Prez in the Washington Design Center. This is when it was back down on D Street. I would go into work and designers would ring the bell and I would trip up and pull their memos for them. And I mean, that's where I started. That was the very beginning of it for me. And like, even to go for like a little bit before that, I guess I was always a kid in art class. Like, I was always taking every kind of art class under the sun, always in the studio, always just like creating and making and drawing and drafting. And that's what I loved doing. But when I was in college, I wasn't sure what that would look like. So I ended up studying cultural anthropology with a fine arts specialty. Mm. And at the very end, and I thought I was going to go into actually mental health, which is not that far from what we do.
Oh my God. I majored in psychology. No kidding. With a heavy, heavy minor in art, because art can't be my real job. Right. So I'm going to be a psychologist. Right.
This was it. I was like, I'll go into mental health and that's what I'm going to do. I know. And it's like, we kind of are actually in mental health and what we do now anyway, but a therapist, totally. At the very end of getting my degree, I realized, I was like, you know what? I can't imagine not doing something creative. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to one of my father's good friends who'd kind of been a mentor to me over the years. Andy, he was a creative himself. He'd done all kinds of amazing creative work. And at the time he was working with Holly Hunt. And this was in the late 90s. So, you know, I mean, it was like Holly Hunt was just the creme de la creme. Absolutely. And he said to me, he's like, why don't you think about starting off in design? And if you're going to do it, start in a showroom. He's like, that's where you need to learn. That's where you should really start out. And so that's how I ended up at the memo library of Duncan Huggins Prez.
I think that's smart, because you learn the vendor side, which is key.
It is so imperative. I mean, the thing is that nobody talks about in school, in design school, is that they don't teach you what you need to know on the job. They don't talk about what a CFA is. They don't talk about a reserve. They don't talk about extending reserves and side marking. And, you know, they don't get into all of those acronyms and nuances. And that's what you have to know. Also, understanding the vendor side, understanding what their process is, understanding their perspective, mm-hmm. how to work well with vendors, how vendors respond to things. It was so imperative. And it also gave me this amazing glimpse into designers, right? Like, designers would come in, I'd have a sense of what their projects were, hearing about different scopes, hearing about different experiences. And so it was this amazing opportunity to learn about fabric, wallpaper, lighting, furniture. And then here on the designer side, like, client experiences, workrooms. Like, I had no idea about all the different kinds of workrooms and why you would specify, you know, upholstery weight versus a drapery weight. Like, yeah. I just learned everything.
Exposure.
Exposure. Every single day it was exposure. And I learned so much. And I was there for almost 2 years. Wow. Before thinking, before having this moment of like, is this really what I'm meant to do? Is this it? And so, even that my poor parents were really wondering what I was thinking.
Did you ever consider being a rep, though, having come from the, I mentioned that only because I had a moment of, how do I get into this business after an internship at Scalamandre? And the manager there was like, if you really want to do design, just go do design. Don't do this rep thing. Nothing wrong with being a rep by any means, but she gave me that moment. I thought, well, because I didn't see a career path from showroom, back room to, you know, being a designer.
It was really hard. It was also like, you know, we're the same age. So it was such a different time, right? And there also wasn't information like readily available. It's not like you could just Google up, how do I do all this? Like, it was such a different time. So I lost a little kind of excitement. You know, I wasn't sure how to make it happen. So I ended up actually going to corporate executive board.
I know that was my
big pivot. Oh, huge pivot, right? And I worked in financial services and member relations, and I ended up in talent management, as it was called in the early 2000s. And that was actually such an amazing experience because I learned all my business writing, business skills, like all of these aspects that would later come in handy, but moreover, also give me a sense and a foundation of how our, what our clients' day-to-day is, right? Mm-hmm. Now, as a business owner, I understand like what our clients are, how they're interacting, what their experiences are. And so it was after then again, about 3 years there that all of a sudden that want and desire for creativity struck again. You know, I was like, I can't be in a cube farm forever, right? You know,
it's like bubbles up. Yeah,
it always bubbles up. And that's what I say to like young people who I meet who are creative. I'm like, you're compelled to create. If you are a creative, you are compelled to create. It's something that you have to do. It's not something that you choose to do.
Yes.
And I think that's so important for people to A, realize and acknowledge and honor. And so I went back. So I thought to myself, okay, now I was far enough into my 20s that I had to really have a plan.
And, I remember that juncture. It's like, uh-oh.
Yeah. And especially, you know, I'd been like promoted pretty well at CUB and there was a very clear path forward there. Yeah. So I applied to Maryland to get a second degree in studio arts, which I finished in, I think it was like 14 months. I finished that studio arts degree. And that gave me all the prereqs that I needed and qualifications to then apply to the Corcoran for my master's in interior design. So it took me a little while, but I came back to design.
My goodness. The Corcoran program is long. I took some evening classes while I was working at an ad agency, similarly doing client service, which I think everyone wants to run their own business, figure out a way to get client service exposure because,
absolutely,
you know, whether it's advertising or CEB, you know, my husband was at CEB for 20 years, actually. I think I forgot.
Yep.
Client service is a great, that's what you do all day long. The creativity part of being a designer is an important part, but then there's majority customer service, client service, and installation. Not to jump ahead to that, but I think that's a, people starting out, get some client service account experience. Yeah.
It is, Liz, like it's so imperative. And it's what I tell, you know, when I tell like young people are coming to me and asking me about being a designer or even friends or family, and everybody has this idea, that must be so fun. And I say, you know what? It's 90% client relations, client services. Like we're just in client services with 10% of creativity.
Yeah.
You have to fundamentally love to work in service. Like that's what we do, right? That is what we do. We get to express ourselves creatively, but hands down, it is about client services. And I actually love that a lot of my clients are, you know, physicians or lawyers or, you know, consultants. And we have this conversation all the time. And I think that they appreciate that they appreciate what we do because it's what they do just with, you know, a different specialty.
Yes, it's so true. I actually love all my lawyer clients because they bill on hourly rates and retainers, not a new structure for them. And they tend to be more left brain, not to overly generalize. And they like things being done for them. They understand service. It's the same thing. And so that's a nice, they get what I'm doing and how I'm set up as a business and off we go. You do, you stay in lane. You do what you do, Liz. I'm going to.
It's totally right. That's exactly it. And it's great. And I did all my technical classes. So I was doing like all my CAD, lighting, construction documents, materials, and a couple general ones. At the same time, was working for two interior designers. And so I was like just in it. And it was a really exciting time because at the time, for example, I was taking my first CAD class and we were working on a project for one of the designers where David Easton was the architect. So I was actively learning CAD. The designer who I worked for, again, had never been exposed to CAD because this was 20 plus years ago. Yeah. And so I would learn line weights and I'd come in to work the next day and there'd be an email from like David Easton's office and I needed to do furniture plans.
Oh my God.
And it was so crazy. But so my CAD teacher had office hours and I think I was the first student ever to go in and use them. And I was like, I would go to his office in the middle of the workday and I'd be like, I have to do an entire house furniture plan. Like, and I needed,
oh my gosh.
I mean, it was trial by fire. I mean, I jumped in to the deep end with it, but it was fabulous because I learned so much. I learned so quickly because there was no other option. You know, it was like we were doing a really high stakes project and all of the sudden designer was like, oh, you know CAD? And I was like,
you're an expert.
I know how to line enter, right? I was like,
I know one part of CAD. This is the part I know. Great. Let's do the whole house. You're hired. And they have no idea. I know. It's really hard. I mean, to learn that. And I always hired young folks to do it for me, because I tried sometimes to learn SketchUp or something, some version of that was supposedly easier. It's really complicated. I have no background.
Oh my gosh. It was like crazy days. Like, I think back to that, I'm like, I can't believe that I kind of did all of that.
I know. So like, you got a second bachelor's in studio art, and then mm-hmm. you went and got your master's in interior design.
I did not finish my master's. So I studied there. And at the time, the two designers that I was working with both said, you know, they were like, don't spend the time and the money to mm-hmm. get, you know, if you want to, like, if you have all the time.
Oh, I did the same thing. Yeah.
Finish that. But they were like, study and get all the technical stuff, get all of your drawing, get all of, again, electrical, like mm-hmm. lighting, construction, like all the stuff, the technical stuff that's really hard, quite frankly, more time intensive to learn on the job than it is to like learn in a class. Yeah. And they were like, that will then support your ability. So that's what I did.
Because it is expensive and it does take time. And I know that was 20 years ago. And now folks could get online and learn CAD or take a singular course. And for a lot of people call and say, oh, I need, you know, how do you get into the industry? And can I work for you? And I would say, if you're not going to go the route you described, just learning CAD and providing that skill to an existing design firm is a nice entry.
Oh, Liz, I say that all the time when I get calls from people either wanting to switch careers and oftentimes I get calls about people wanting to switch careers more than like people like kind of starting out. And I say, that's the number one thing. Take a CAD class, because it's also, you have to recognize, like, outside of just like the beauty of things, you also have to get an understanding if scale, proportion, and if that piece of it registers for you. Because the soft goods, I mean, beautiful fabrics and wallpapers and paint colors, that's pretty, I mean, it's pretty easy, right? Like if you get it, you get it.
Yeah.
If you have an eye, right? You'll be fine. But the technical side of it, which is imperative that, you know, that you have, especially if you're young or, to your point, transitioning and you want to like put the value proposition over hiring you or somebody else. That's the number one thing you can do. And there are great online classes. Like, there's these 3-day classes that people on our team will do as a reboot if they're a little rusty. They haven't been doing as much, like a little rusty. And it's like a 3-day class and they just go through everything and it's great. But I think, like, hands down, that's the number one thing. And a lot of people, it's funny, a lot of people who I talk to who are like thinking about these career changes, and they're like, do I really need to know how to draft? And I'm like, this is what we do is not HGTV.
Yeah.
You need, right? I'm like, you actually really do.
Yeah.
Like, what, we're recovering sofas, not with staple guns and sheets, you know?
Oh my God. Can you imagine? Hey, client, I'm going to take this leftover rug and I'm going to staple it to your sofa, and it's going to be amazing. And everyone goes, wow. And then it falls apart when you leave. I mean, I used to watch that stuff religiously before. I used to love Trading Spaces, by the way. Shout out to Trading Spaces. Before I got into the biz, I was like, oh my God, am I going to have to paint and reupholster in a day? I'm not. But I mean, I'd have to tell clients that this is not reality TV. This is not reality, period. Yeah.
Right. There's no basis in reality whatsoever. So
learn a skill, learn a marketable skill. I mean, when people call and ask, can I work with you? Are you hiring? And you either have a marketable skill, like you can do CAD, or because otherwise you need to get that experience and the experience of project management, of working with clients. And I've talked to other designers who've said, I had this great intern, I really would hire them, but I actually need someone who knows more about managing projects and anticipating client needs than I can, you know, I don't have time to invest that in this person. So it's hard for young, new folks getting into the business or transitioning careers. It's hard to get that experience if no one will take the time to teach you. A lot of us are solo operators or have small teams, and you need to come into the door with something we can use right away, whether it's CAD or project management.
Like, project management is it. I have found that people who are transferring in from events thrive, because you are, you're used to so much project management, so many details, kind of high stakes, generally larger budgets, and the client factor, right? You're working with a client in a stressful situation, and it's very similar, like, skill set, in that it's all of those things and this strong piece of project management. So I think, you know, somebody with project management background, you get it. You understand. It's so that piece is so transferable.
I think I had one of the best project managers come down from New York who worked on million-dollar weddings. And she told me what her events process was like. And I thought, if you can work with brides who are spending that much money to host a wedding in the fanciest place in the Bahamas or wherever she was, France, I said, you've got it made, because this is not as high stakes and we have more than one day to get it right. So come on board. She was ready. She was primed. I had forgotten about that, but I thought, not about her, but I mean, the fact the events connection is a
The events connection. Yes. We've had now a few women who've come with events backgrounds and they, I mean, every time just like just nail it because they can balance all, you know, all of the things, all of the work, all of the time, all of the sensitivity, and with like, you know, grace under pressure.
Yes, the moving parts, grace under pressure, and how to keep it professional when things go sideways, because inevitably some things do, and it's with the outside of our control.
That's right. And figuring out how to maintain a sense of calm and positivity. I mean, that's another big thing. Like, if you're getting into this, there's so many moments that can be frustrating or difficult or isolating. Mm-hmm. And like what we were talking about, our designing women, you know, support group, you know, we're lucky in DC that there's such an amazing group of designers. And at any moment, it's so comforting to know. I mean, you've been on, how many times have I sent our group a text like, I need 14 yards of a pale pink fabric today, you know, or, you know,
who's got something in their garage? Who's got an extra project manager in their garage? I think that's
always.
I'm hiring again. I'm hiring.
It's like all of the things. So that is having leaning into the amazing community that wherever you are, you know, wherever you are, but tapping into that, getting engaged, finding a group who are supportive, and it makes such a difference, you know, after like a tough day or a great day, right? Like to being able to share those wins or losses. And
it's so great. So you went back to school, you educated yourself to the max more than I did. You had great work experience. What was that turning point where you said, I'm going to, you know, did you work for a designer full time before? Oh, you did. I do know.
Yes,
that.
I did.
Firm? Yeah.
Yep. So for 5 years, I worked with Mike Johnson, who owned 1659, which was the original mid-century modern club in town, way before Mad Men.
I would go get, I still have lamps from that store. I love that shop.
Yeah. I remember Sally coming in one day and buying like a buffet. She was like, I'm having a party tonight. I need a buffet. Well, and like running out, you know, I mean, it was like such a great shop.
Yeah, it was.
And then he was really good friends with Andrew Law, who I went and worked for five years, I guess. And so just had amazing experience, right? Amazing experience. But I was running everything. I was doing all the project management. And that's where I learned, you know, design. We were doing everything, design manager and you know, dropping into crazy CAD experiences. And the first day, this was so funny. The first day that I got sent out to do paint samples on, you know, at a construction project. And I did not know the first of all, I wrote on the walls in pen, you know, I wrote the paint colors in pen. And then I also, for some reason, ended up covered in paint. And I remember going to, it was like the Panera on Wisconsin Avenue next to the Duran shop afterwards. And I had like paint all over me. And the woman at Panera was like, what have you been doing? I mean, I was like, I painted my hair. And I was like,
I got all in on this selection. I'm in the paint. I'm trying.
It was like I was back in art school, like throwing paint all over the place. But it was great. You know, it was like just jump in and just do it and learn. And it was fabulous. And so all of those experiences from like the design center to CEB to art school to the Corcoran to working for those designers for all those years. Then put me in a good position where, you know, we were starting a family and just, you know, it was like a big kind of like life change moment. And again, I just didn't have the foggiest clue, like how to start a business or to do anything. So I found a women's center that educates women, and it was an hour away, and they did free counseling on like all kinds of different things. Hey. And so I would
Wow.
After work, drive. It was like South Virginia. I would drive down there and I would do a class to learn how to fill out my paperwork, to get, you know, get everything set up. I mean, it kind of boggles my mind that I did all this. Versus now you can like click on a button on, you know, you say, Siri, set up a LLC for me. And she's like, done, you know.
Bing. Yeah.
Bing. Right.
I do have a funny memory of when you and I were talking about business stuff and I think I had a question about running a certain aspect of it. And you're like, hang on. And you opened your trunk and gave me this. I think I still have it. I should have given it back, a textbook or some wonderful book on how to run a design business. It's black. What's it called?
Yeah. It's,
I have two copies. Oh. So take it.
I will. Here, I have it right here.
You can get it. We can link it in our show notes.
I know. I was going to say it's the business of design, which is going to show up backwards.
How can we get a name known as the business of design? That says it all.
Business of design. Balancing creativity and profitability. I still like pull this out sometimes and reference it. I'm sure that a lot of the statistics in it at this point are possibly out of date, because I think it was published 20 years ago, but it's still a great book. That is so funny.
What are some things you reference? What do you reference? Do you remember, like, not to put you on the spot, but like topics, what do you love that book for? What do you go back to?
As we're scaling and growing, I go back to different like setups of firms and how different people set things up in terms of leadership and like senior designers, how people implement like procurement and project management. We've had this conversation about the like project management piece of things in a post-COVID world where all of a sudden, it used to be you would put in an order and you would track it twice and it would show up. And now, project management, it's a huge piece of what we're doing. It's so much larger and so much more time intensive than it was. And so it's interesting for me to study and just to talk to other friends. I think everybody, all of whom have been on the show already with you, about how are they thinking about like expediting procurement, project management? So for me, that's really interesting, just to see different structures and to compare like interior architecture or architecture firms versus design firms. So I find all that interesting. I'd say another great resource for anybody who's not familiar with the industry is Business of Home. I mean, they have so many amazing resources. I just think that they have great information. And for anybody who's curious about the industry, they're like, what is happening in design? You know, they send out like a daily email. And it's just interesting to start getting familiar with trends and topics and conversations that people are having and events and things like that.
I love Business of Home. And actually next month in April, they're doing an article on outsourcing procurement. And they interviewed me about process management and what I've outsourced. So I'm excited to see what they've researched and put together, because the business continues to evolve. And, you know, post-COVID especially, and clients are willing to accept more things that are done online as well. I don't completely replace presentation process, but I do in a Zoom board and a kind of a concept presentation remotely to get me further down the path before I have that physical presentation with samples, because those meetings are time consuming and they can be 2 hours and trying to get all of the decision makers in the room challenging. So I've kept some of those COVID, Zoom things built into our process just because more efficient, but procurement too. And now there's different services out there that will do the purchasing.
I think, right, if you're starting out and it's a great way starting out to experiment with a lot of different vendors, right? To figure out without committing to, opening order, minimums and all of that stuff, just to see who you like, who is good to work with, who has a lot of damages, who doesn't have a lot of damages.
My goodness. Right. And you don't know. And I think as those of us that are veterans in the trade bring to the client piece, hey, we've worked with these vendors for 20 years. We know this already, which you can't fast forward when you're starting out. But I try to remind clients of that. Hey, you're paying for this known quantity, these vendor relationships that are established. So if something shows up damaged, or it probably won't, because we've already managed it behind the scenes,
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, all the time behind the scenes of it's problem solving, right? Oftentimes I'd say, I work in client services and creative problem solving.
It's so tricky, because the things that even if you manage it to a T and your team is checking in with regularity, it's something can still surprise you. And unfortunately, the client doesn't see the behind the scenes part. We're still billing them hourly. And then something goes wrong. It's like, what are you doing? It makes us, drives me crazy. It makes us look bad. And I feel defensive to say, I've been checking. My team's been checking, you know?
Oh, it's the stuff that you cannot possibly make up. I mean, you just cannot make up. No. And we've had, I'm trying to think, there was something last year and it was so ridiculous. Like what the vendors had done, it was so ridiculous. I called the client and I just said, this is going to sound like the most ridiculous thing, but I'm just going to tell you this because this is what's happening. And I was like, and I'm not making this up. Like, and at the end of it, and she's like, oh, please, you could not have made that up. You know? I mean, it was so ridiculous. And you're just like, I can't all day. All I try to do is my best. Like we try to do our best. We are so on top of it. We are so everybody in this industry. We're all type A. We're all control freaks. Like, the fact that things can still go awry, you're like, you know, and then especially after doing this for 20 plus years, and then when something new and something that's never happened before happens, you're like, I had this happen.
I had a quadrille wallpaper or fabric rather. So it was a fabric and a tropical storm or typhoon took out the printing area in a very remote island place, which I felt terrible for the islanders, but also dang it, that client had already bought that and approved it. It was the sofa in the middle of the room. And I really needed this sort of batik pattern that I could not replace. I was like, I hope the village is okay. I can't wait for them to rebuild, to block stamp this. Darn it for everybody. I hope they're safe. But I mean, you literally can't make that up. So I had to go to the client. Typhoon took out the place that prints the fabric. So what do you think about these other options? You're like, wait a minute, what? That, I'm sorry, repeat? I was like, everybody's okay, right. I think. But the printing press is down. I mean, it's so unbelievable that it sounds, you know, it makes us laugh, but it's, you know, it was a horrible storm and hopefully everybody was okay.
Right. First and foremost.
Yeah.
It's the stuff. I mean, right. If you have to laugh, I think that's the other thing. Like, and I tell my team this all the time, like, just we have to laugh. But you know, when these ridiculous things happen, like we will solve it. We are an amazing, strong team, and we will take care of it. But like, if you don't laugh, you'll cry because it's just so crazy.
And I think clients do eventually learn, not eventually, but they will appreciate after going through either they're building a home or a whole house furnishing project, that thank goodness they have a team because there's so many moving parts that at least they can say, Liz, Marika, can you deal with this? And then go back to their regularly scheduled program where we're in the background going, and dealing with the typhoons and the shipping issues. And that's what you pay us to do. I'm not complaining.
Right.
But it's a service. It's a nice to have service, but it is taking care of things that be super time consuming for you. Yeah.
We had a client who wanted to field a delivery. She wanted to, it was an antique that she was purchasing. And I was like, that's great. You know, she found this fabulous antique she was so excited about. And she was like, I've got it. Weeks and weeks she was dealing with this. And then in the end, the day of, it was like, they rang the doorbell and maybe she didn't hear it. And so then they went away.
No, like, don't go away.
But she was so funny. She, after this, like, it was just terrible. And she called me and she's like, I just have to say, thank you so much for everything you do. She's like, I'm this one piece, this one antique that I tried to buy, you know, when I was in Italy and I thought it'd be so fun, you know. And she's like, I just appreciate everything that you and your team do every single day. Aww. And I was like, well, I'm sorry that it took this terrible experience. But, and of course, you know, my office, because they had contacts with the people, were able to rectify it and get it turned around and taken care of in a couple of days. And she was just like, okay, thank you. You know, I give up. Thank you. I appreciate it. like write that. And for like her hair, you know, to color her hair after all the gray hair she sprouted because of it. You know, it was just crazy. So
it's all the things, and you have to go through some of that exposure to develop some confidence and experience so that you don't roll up deer in headlights some of these projects. Again, back to those younger folks starting out, the people that come on my team that are new, you know, they freak out, understandably, as we all did when something like that happens or typhoon comes. And it's like, I always quote Gretchen, who says, this is not open heart surgery.
Yes.
Be okay. It is money. And money's important. It's an investment, but nobody's going to die. Just keep it in mind. It's decorating. We're going to survive this, you know, and I have to keep that perspective too, because it's easy to get caught up in the, I want to make the experience perfect. I am type A. I want everything to be managed and, you know, please yeah. everybody, people pleaser, that I'm recovering yes. pleaser. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. We are all, that's the thing. That's the number one secret to being a good interior designer, is being a type A people pleaser insomnia.
Yeah. Only the good ones have those traits, I must say. Oh, well, I've taken us completely off track. So find a minute. Let's get back on the track. You've had this wonderful experience base, and then you were well positioned to start your own firm. And yep. so that was probably, sounds like 5 to 7 year journey.
It was, yeah. I mean, it was a long, long journey, about probably 7 years about, with great experience. And then I started my own firm, in 07, and I had my first son, and it was like giving birth to all these different things, you know, and it was great. And I was very, very fortunate to have some great clients right out of the gate. You know, my like personal community of friends and family was very supportive. And as was like the broader just like industry, I'd been working. So a lot of people at the design center knew me. And so they passed out my name. And that's nice. I was just incredibly grateful for so much support through like the major financial crisis, which was quite something.
Little blip.
So then things kind of took off, and we had nice kind of steady, sustained growth. I had my second son, and then the creative itch started itching again in a different way.
Oh, good. I'm ready for this. Yes. The creative itch. Yeah. Tell me.
So this was in 2015, and I really missed, I missed painting. Like my degree was fine arts, but I specialized in painting. And I was like, I really want to just do, I love what I do every day creatively, but as we talked about, mostly it's honestly client services. And I really was just craving a new kind of creativity and kind of a new challenge. Like, as I said, like the way that I started my business was like finding the Women's Resource Center and doing all the research. And like, I love this deep part of the curve. I love like chewing on things and figuring stuff out and not understanding stuff. And so I thought, well, why not start a line of textiles? Why not?
Sure.
At the time, I thought I would be doing it just for my own projects, like stuff that I could use for our own projects and just something that would be fun and interesting. And then I was so lucky. I did the 2014 design house, DC design house. Somebody, I can't remember who the designer was, but they used a bunch of Victoria Larson textiles. And Victoria is based out of Annapolis and is a textile designer. And so I called Victoria, kind of cold called her, and she actually offered a service of consulting to young, you know, to people who are starting a textile line. So she was so kind. She talked to me about vector formatting and how to establish a repeat. And I mean, things that, you know, that I just had no idea, printers and different kinds of printing and light steadfastness. And man, I mean, I just started learning and researching and making connections, and then kind of fell into a couple people saw the textiles, and lo and behold, a couple showrooms wanted to start carrying them. And amazing. All of a sudden, now I was in like the memo game, and I was in wings, and I was like in sampling, and I was like, whoa.
Well, and how many patterns did you start out with out of the gate when you're getting into memo game?
So the first collection was 5 patterns, but the big mistake I made until I started calculating all the numbers was the SKUs, right? Because I was like, oh, I love San Michelle in these 10 different colorways. Like, why wouldn't I do it in 10 different colorways? So I had like so many SKUs, you know. It was like Pompeii, I think I did in like 6 different colorways, you know. No, this is where I just, you know, again, I thought I was just doing it more or less for myself. And then all of a sudden, now having it in a showroom and now having to supply like 40 memos of each SKU, and all of a sudden realizing that, surging. I will never disrespect a fabric memo ever again, ever again. They are so, you spend so much money on sampling. I can't even tell you. So then it was, okay, we need to really like put on our business hat and kind of pull it back, analyze, like, let's really get this set up. Cause I had set it up as more something small. And I thought might be stay small. And then it kind of very quickly became something bigger. And a former client of mine at the same time reached out to me, and it was very funny. We had coffee, and she was like, so what are you doing? And I was like, I honestly have no idea. She had worked on Wall Street for a number of years. Our son, you know, our older sons are the same age. And she's like, let me come in and help you. And I was like, hey. Great. And so, you know, she's a queen of data and came in and like analyzed stuff and really helped look strategically and growth and all this stuff. And we focused obviously a lot on growth, but mostly what I wanted to do on the textile side was to create, like, I wanted to be a designer's tool. I didn't want it to be just about the colors that we were releasing or even just the patterns we were releasing, but I want it to be something that designers look at and they say, oh, I can custom color this. We have very little minimum. We don't do a custom upcharge. Like, I want to make it so that every designer can use it and create a completely new pattern for every project that they're working on. And it's just like a template, right? They're like, okay, I'm going to use Sam Michelle, but I want to do it in two colors. And we do all of it in-house. And it's super, super easy. And it's, again, it's like, I think being a designer right now, the value proposition is hard because there's so many of our vendors are selling everything online and everything's so accessible and you've seen everything. I feel like I've seen everything. Yeah. There's nothing new outside of making it yourself. So as a designer, like, I know a lot of us, right? We're doing all kinds of our own, like, custom, you know, custom furniture pieces. Like, we do a ton of vintage, just from like an environmental perspective. But so I really, really wanted to have this textile line, like, designed by designer for designers. Like, that's kind of our motto.
And to make it, to create it from your own perspective as a designer, that makes a lot of sense. Creating something, a need, fulfilling a need, customization, ease, not making it so expensive to customize that it's off-putting and you're unsellable, really.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and Gretchen, you know, getting set up, I like showed her the heavy, you know, the heavy oyster linen, and it's like, we went to the workrooms. How does this upholster? How is this going to hang? Just getting all of that feedback so that, again, it's for designers to be able to express themselves as much as they can and to be able to create something for a client, even if it is pillow, you know, just fabric for pillows or fabric for a chair, that is completely one of a kind. Been a lot of fun. It's been a total journey. I've learned all kinds of different things that I never thought I would know. We, again, like, one of our kind of something that's very important to me just as a mom with young kids is the environment. So we're a member of the Sustainable Furnishings Council. We've sourced all of our, like, shipping and packaging materials compostable. You know, we have different shipping facilities based on where we're shipping to minimize our carbon footprint. Like, we've really, really run with it also. So it makes me just feel, just again, like, as a mom, I worry so much about our kids' future. So everything that we have done into like manufacturing, we've done with like great pride. And so that makes me happy too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can feel good about it. And the sustainability factor needs to be addressed. I mean, you were talking about all these memos and disrespecting the memos, not disrespecting the memos. I've got so many and I don't. Were you involved in a project about, I feel like I remember something, memo recycling or repurposing. Was that you?
Yes. Tell me about Fabric Scrap. So Fabric Scrap is a company, and I think they're out of like the New York area, where they will take fabrics back and they will recycle them. So it's like, and we were trying to put together a big truck down here because we all have so many remnants, right? It's like remnants and cuts of materials that just aren't usable. You know, it's like the odd triangle from the repeat of the pillow and this, that, the other. And it's disgusting to think that that's just going to end up in a landfill. And they will recycle it or upcycle it for, you know, for like upholstery fill or all kinds of different things. Period. There are all these neat people who are doing great work to help, but you have to set the intention of identifying that you don't want to be part of, you know, like part of that problem. We have a wallpaper book that our intern pulled out yesterday and she said it's being discontinued. And I was like, okay, well, let's figure out what, you know, I'm sure an art school or in one of the elementary schools around here would love it and they could do something, you know, with it. It's like just setting the intention of being a little bit more thoughtful. It takes a little bit more time, but it's not hard, you know?
I wish there was something like the clothing donation, for lack of a better word, there looked like clean dumpster, so to speak. Yeah. The green.
Yeah. Like Green Drop.
Do they have that for fabric and memos? I mean, if we had a big one here, wouldn't it be great? Either at the design center or somewhere in town. I mean, come get it. It's so hard for them probably to scale within money. And
well, that's the thing. It's so expensive for them. And it's so, I mean, you also want to try to do something like localized because you start defeating the purpose if you're sending trucks 200 miles to do stuff. But it is true. And I know like a lot, at least even with like memos and things like that, a lot of the schools will use them. There are a lot of like quilting organizations for some scraps. So quilters love scraps.
And again, it's like it would be, it's getting creative on how to be sustainable.
That's right. It's just, it's spending a little bit of time, a little bit of intention. Like for us with our packaging, you know, we can sometimes receive packages from vendors and I'm just thinking about the cost. It's like, I got a box the other day and box and tissue and ribbons. And I was like, okay, this was a major expense to put together, but B, now I feel so gross about throwing out all this packaging.
Yes.
Right. I was like, it's so, I feel terrible that, you know, like what am I, like, it's all this packaging. So
or how about those big boxes of memos or like fabric books that I didn't order? I get them. I don't have a place to store them because I'm not in a big office. And so I'm like, what do I, and I don't have a place to recycle them. I've thrown them away. You know, I don't know what to do with them. And that's terrible. And I haven't been thoughtful or creative about it. Now I need to be.
But you know what? It's taking time out of it. And you're also like, don't ship, you know, all these boxes that are getting shipped around that were nobody's requesting. And so it's like, and I get it from the textile side, you know, as a textile vendor, we need to get our stuff out there and the word out, but not do it in a wasteful way or anything. So it's, I don't know. I mean, there's so many questions, right? It's like, there's so many different, everybody means well, and we're all trying to, you know, trying to do it the right way.
I'm going to stop us right there as we pick up part two next week in our conversation on Behind the Drapery. Thanks for being here with us and see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Behind the Drapery, where we pull back the curtain on the interior design industry through stories, insights, and creative processes that shape the spaces we create. Make sure you subscribe to get the latest episodes from your favorite podcast platform and visit our website at lizlevininteriors.com for more information.